Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, September 30th, 2017. It's just a few seconds after 2 UTC as we're starting to record this. I am Sam Minter, and Yvonne Beau is not here today. He'd been planning to be here all week. We'd moved our regularly scheduled time later in the week to accommodate his schedule, but then he called me just a few hours before we were going to record the show, saying he couldn't make it. And so Ed is joining us today. Hello, Ed.
Hello. Hello.
And I do want to mention for a few seconds before we jump in with Ed, why Yvonne is indisposed. Because basically, he is working with his family. They've to do some Hurricane Maria relief for Puerto Rico. They've gotten a bunch of people together. They've got a plane. They're taking a bunch of supplies to Puerto Rico, and then they're bringing a whole bunch of people back to Florida. From Yvonne's family, and I don't know all the details of that, but Yvonne's been sort of sending me updates all week about how various members of his family are doing and how things are going there, and especially the people who are more in need in his family. They're doing some stuff to help him out, and so that's what he is doing right now, is actually preparing stuff to get on that plane and all of this kind of stuff. He's busy, and for a good cause, I guess, to help out people who need it in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. So,
yeah, well, wish him well.
Yeah, very much so, and I presume we'll get an update from him next week on some of that. And just a quick agenda, real quick. And, this is, I asked Ed, for topics, and he came up with a nice list. So I didn't even do anything. This is Ed's list. Ed wanted to talk a little bit about the friendly skies of United. I gather you've been flying lately.
I just spent most of last night and this today in friendly skies of United.
There you go. And then we want to talk about islands. What exactly are islands? Because apparently our president just learned about that and was sharing. And we're going to talk about the tax bill. The Republicans have moved on from healthcare to taxes, and now there's all kinds of conversation about taxes and what that would do and economic growth and all this kind of thing. There was obviously in the last week a big hubbub about the NFL and people kneeling and protesting in various ways, and what was all this about, and a bunch of people got really upset, and a bunch of other people are not upset, and what's going on. The administration has also been doing some things related to the ACA or Obamacare in terms of open enrollment and sort of slowing down their involvement and doing whatever they can to help it not succeed, I guess. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then Julia Louis-Dreyfus's breast cancer and energy. And that's a lot of topics, so they're not necessarily going to be whole segments. So it's kind of almost like a little bit of a lightning roundish stuff, but maybe a little bit longer each. We'll see how it goes, or maybe we'll make a segment out of each one of them and just go a little shorter. But we'll see how that goes. Anyway, that's our topic list for today. So Ed,
yes,
what's this with United? Are you being sarcastic with friendly?
No, actually, I'm not. I had to make a quick unplanned trip to Florida last night, and we called, as I recall, it was somewhere around 6 or 6:30 to make flight reservations. My wife did it through the internet with United, and we got a round trip ticket there. Going down at, I think we left around 9 o'clock, and then my return trip was to be at around 11 this morning. A reasonable price, they didn't gouge us because we were kind of stuck at the last minute sort of thing. Even more, as I, being old and senile, as I was going through the security, I somehow managed to completely dispose of my boarding pass. And so I was suddenly left without a boarding pass. I had gone through security and everything, but didn't have a boarding pass. So I frantically ran to the gate, and they said, no problem, printed me off another one, and gave it to me with a smile and said thank you to me. Then we flew down there. I spent the night, waiting to fly back in the morning. Turned out that I could catch, if it was available, a 7 o'clock in the morning flight instead of 11. So at around 5:30 or 6 this morning, I went up to the gate and asked them, could I get on the earlier flight? And they said, well, of course, if there's a seat available. And there was a seat, and no extra fee or anything else, and actually got us in about 10 minutes early. And in that whole time and all those things, they didn't drag anyone off the plane, didn't beat anybody. It was really quite pleasant.
So let me understand this correctly. You had a last minute airline trip, and everything went well. Everything went smoothly. Everyone was friendly to you, and you didn't have a bad experience at all.
Not at all. In fact, the pilot on today's return flight, the pilot was a gentleman who came out after we were all boarded and waiting for the last clearances and everything, and said, I don't like to make announcements from the cockpit, because then you don't know who I am and I don't know who you are. And I really like to meet and greet my customers. And so he talked for about 5 minutes, telling us who he was, who the co-pilot was, cracked a couple jokes instead of the usual, thing that you get, a bunch of static and an announcement. If you look under the right wing, you'll see the ocean. So I'm like, quite a pleasant guy. And he says, I think we're going to arrive on time today, and went off and flew the plane.
Okay, then. So a thumbs up for United.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've fun. They've gotten a lot of bad press in the past couple of years, but this was a most pleasant experience, I thought.
Okay, well, then next up, let's talk about islands. Back after this.
AlexMZWeb.com, being Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day, YouTube by night, AlexMZWeb.com. AlexMZWeb is AlexMZWeb, and .com is period and then com.
And we're back. So Ed.
Yes.
What's this with islands?
Well, the reason I wrote that down is as I went through the news today and watched various television news broadcasts, I found this wonderful explanation for our president of one of the reasons it's hard to take care of Puerto Rico. It turns out that Puerto Rico is an island. And it's an island, to quote our president, it's an island in the middle of water, big water, and in fact, ocean water. And yes, I guess that had never occurred to some of us.
You know,
he says you can't just drive trucks up to it.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Maybe they should build a bridge.
Yeah, he didn't mention that even if you drive trucks up to it, right now you can't drive trucks around the island because the roads are destroyed and there's no infrastructure. But, that's coming later, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we're 9 months into the presidency and much longer than that Trump has been in the public eye running as a candidate or whatever. And you'd think at this point we'd stop. You know, I guess we're not surprised anymore at comments like that, but they're still notable because it's like, really? I guess there's a question of, is he really that stupid in terms of not knowing these things, or is he just incoherent and unable to, like, speak effectively about things?
I think it's a little bit of a lot of things. I don't think he's stupid. It's hard for me to accept that the man is stupid. It just doesn't make sense. But I think he doesn't think things through that he's saying. And for instance, the press interview he gave today talking about it, once again, everything he does is, this has never happened before, nothing this big. And so the relief for this hurricane is the biggest the world has ever seen.
Everything he ever talks about is the biggest the world has ever seen. He doesn't know how to describe anything any other way.
Yeah, it seems that way. And it's kind of, it's almost self-defeating because it gets so old. And so trite after a while.
Yeah, well, aside from Trump's awful rhetoric on this, the bottom line is it's a mess there, and it Yvonne last week had sort of said, hey, yeah, it's a mess. Yeah, it's bad, but it's not as bad as what some of the islands got. And I think that's probably still the case, but it is a situation that is getting worse as time progresses still. Because as you go longer without electricity, as you go longer without reliable source of gasoline to power generators and things like that, a lot of the things that you rely on, and maybe you can get away with, you know, hey, you lose power for a few days or a week, you can deal with it. You lose power for a month, it's a little harder, you know. So anyway, things are still developing there. Things are ramping up to get various supplies and relief there, but it's apparently going fairly slowly, and there are lots of logistical problems as well in terms of things getting to the island, but then not being able to be distributed within the island, etc. So,
It's beyond understanding in many ways. I can understand that. But our nation has so many ways that we could be preparing for these better. On one of the rooms that I've been talking with people this week, we talked about the Comfort, the USS Comfort, which is
a hospital ship, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting hospital ship. It was one of the huge mega tankers, oil tankers, and we bought that and then refitted it at a cost, as I recall, it was somewhere around $1 billion back in the late 80s. As a hospital ship, and we have this. It's a wonderful thing. Its primary mission is to, if we go to war, to be able to set up what are called a tertiary healthcare things. In war wounds, you have the basically first aid station, emergency room, that's right down at the division levels, and then you have several sorts of secondary hospitals, which are 400 to 800 bed hospitals that have lots of equipment and can do major surgery and things like that, and prepare people to evacuate back to the States. At the next level, you have sort of a theater, massive hospital, and that's what the Comfort is. It's a 1,000-bed hospital that's out of the fighting area. It's out at sea, but people can be evacuated to it and stabilized and then flown back to the States for longer term rate. And it's a wonderful thing. Well, we are not at war very much of the time when we need that size of a hospital. So the issue comes up, well, how do we keep it not in mothballs? Because if it's in mothballs, it'll take you several months to get it up to steam. Plus, you have to train people. When you got a 1,000-bed hospital, you can't just suddenly throw, 3,000 people in it and start taking care of people. They have to be trained. To me, the logical thing is this thing should be deployed to catastrophes fairly often. It ought to be equipped and ready. Well, the response to that, they said, well, it is mostly being manned by reserve component people, and it takes several weeks to get them mobilized, ready to go, and into the ship and go. So we can't deploy it in less than several weeks. Why not deploy it with active duty healthcare people and then backfill by healthy the active duty facilities with the reservists? We did a fair amount of that actually during Desert Storm, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of assets that we could get onto the ground in a hell of a hurry when we have these kinds of catastrophes. And it comes across, one of the issues is we have always had a complete separation of military and police forces. Police forces work within the states and take care of policing. Military go out and fight battles. And we said we don't deploy our active duty military in the states because right. We don't want to have coups.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean we couldn't look at some ways to have those active duty people train in manners that also, by the way, help our citizen. But that would take some real planning and thinking and a Congress that works together and is friendly to each other and doesn't call each other names, I guess, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned we don't want military coups, but I think that the aversion to using the military domestically you know, has good reasons behind it, not just coups, but sort of the preeminence of just generally the thought of preeminence of civilian authorities wherever possible. However, having said that, when you are, you know, reacting to, you know, major events like this, that's exactly the kind of situation where you want to say, we're just going to throw everything we have at it. Yeah. In order to solve the problem short term, and we're not going to set a long term precedent. We're not going to have, like, you know, the military providing healthcare for Puerto Rico forever or anything like that. You know, it's just bringing to bear the resources that you have as quickly as possible. I mean, I suppose the answer on, you know, keeping something like the Comfort staffed and ready to go at all times is, you know, it's expensive.
Oh yeah,
you know, And that's the case generally in for, you know, keeping things in readiness such that they can be deployed instantly, is that, you know, you have to have additional staffing. You have to have all kinds of things ramped up to a level that, frankly, most of the time would be sitting there doing nothing.
Well, and I think you can't really keep it absolutely instantly deployable. But I would say that we ought to set some sort of a goal saying that this thing could be steaming within a week. Mm-hmm. You know, say you set up a goal, set up a mission plan, and then say to the soldiers, okay, now you plan. How can you have this ship go from in port to steaming to wherever we want to send it in 7 days or less? And let's find out, what is that? Is that going to cost too much? Is it not going to cost? What does it take to do it? And then, you know, then we can start negotiating and say, well, maybe we can't do it in 7 weeks. Maybe we can only do it in 10 or whatever. But right now, it seems like what happens is we have a catastrophe and people start running around and saying, well, let's send this, let's send that, let's do this, let's do that. And then, you know, 5 or 6 days afterwards, someone says, hey, we've got the Comfort, let's send it. Well, okay, that takes 2 weeks. By the time it gets down there, they don't have a mission anymore.
Well, hopefully. I mean, we'll see. Yeah. There might still be plenty of need in another week or so.
Yeah, Puerto Rico is going to have needs for a long time. But most catastrophes, I mean, Houston and Florida are, you know, not recovered, but certainly well on the way to recovery right now. And,
right.
I don't know what happens to Puerto Rico and what's the other island, Bernubo, that was just essentially leveled.
Well, there were a number of the smaller islands that were very, very seriously impacted either by one of the various hurricanes over the last month. But
and then apparently this evening's news mentions that there's another tropical depression headed towards Puerto Rico.
Oh, another one? Oh, goody. I hadn't actually seen that yet.
Yeah, maybe it won't be a hurricane, but it'll be rain. And it's apparently heading that direction tonight. It's just, you know.
Well, just checking. I just checked the National Hurricane Center, and what they've got is a disturbance to the east of Puerto Rico with, at the moment, less than 40% chance of becoming a tropical cyclone. But it's And there's another one right over Florida right now with about a 50% chance. So, you know, we're still in the middle of the season. Things can happen. Yeah. And, you know.
Well, you know, we have put massive amounts of heat into the oceans in the past, actually 100 years or so. And I think that heat is finally starting to take its toll, and we're getting not so much more hurricanes, but stronger ones. When's the last time we had 3 Category 5 hurricanes in less than a month?
I think if I remember right, the answer was something like 2004. So it's not that long ago.
Yeah.
But so in terms of, okay, the hospital ship is one thing, but, you know, just summarizing the Puerto Rican situation again, there's massive power outages. There's logistical problems getting supplies to people. There are medical issues that the hospital ship potentially helps with, but There's all kinds of other things. As you mentioned, roads are torn up. The power needs to be restored. There's all kinds of things that, the criticism I keep hearing is if this exact situation was happening in Iowa, it would be getting a shitload more attention than it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, along that same line, though, the military does a lot more than just healthcare. And for instance, even in the Second World War, when we would have a airfield bombed and virtually destroyed, that thing, the Seabees could have that airfield back up and operating in 24 hours or less. Remember when they dropped the Moab, the mother of all bombs? They were talking about the reason for that is that if all we did was to hit the airways, the runways with regular bombs, that even Syria, it could or not. That was, hell, I forgot. Was that in? That was, yeah, it was in Syria. They could have their airfield back up and operating in a day or two.
And
so what we had to do, yeah. And if you use a Moab, then you can have it out for longer. My point is that the Seabees and the engineer forces in the military can get in there and do temporary to permanent fixes on those roads and bridges in a hell of a lot less. They have bridges that can virtually be laid down in an hour that will take tanks.
Right.
So, but we don't seem to think we can deploy these assets. And I guess the question in my mind is, why not?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a question, and as I said, I think that there's also a real question here in terms of, is this getting less attention because it is Puerto Rico and it's not North Carolina or somewhere? And because, I noticed all the news reports were very good, like reminding in every single headline, these are Americans. Mm-hmm. They are American citizens, blah, blah, blah. Because I think they're intentionally counteracting the fact that, honestly, if you ask random American off the street, they're not going to perceive Puerto Rico as part of the U.S.
There's a fair number of our legislators who fail to realize that there was some discussion. I don't remember when or where, but some discussion this week. Well, we can't evacuate those people into the states. We don't need any more immigrants. They're American citizens, but they're American citizens with virtually no rights of a vote because their vote doesn't count for much other than their local political stuff.
Despite their population being greater than 21 states, as I saw repeatedly pointed out over the last few days.
They're American citizens without a number of the tax benefits that the rest of us get. And yet we say, well, they're going broke. Well, they're going broke because of some of the things we do to them.
But
this shipping law, this Jones Law thing.
Right. But interestingly enough, I also saw at least one comparison to our relief effort to a number of years back when an earthquake hit Haiti. A number of years back. And our response to help Haiti was apparently faster than our response right now to help Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm not necessarily implying something nefarious as opposed to just disorganization and incompetence. But there might be a decent whiff of just this not bubbling up as a priority because, it's a bunch of Spanish-speaking brown people, off away somewhere, as opposed to, if the hurricane had gone right through Mar-a-Lago in Florida, we might have got a lot more attention to that situation, I don't know.
I think, to some extent, that's what we see through our society, that it's the old white privilege thing. The white neighborhoods get care a hell of a lot quicker. Shouldn't be, but it is.
Okay, let's take a break. We will come back, and we will talk about taxes.
All right.
Back after
this. One of my favorite subjects.
Yeah, and paying them's fun too.
Yeah.
Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, so I guess we should mention briefly that the Republicans' last effort to get rid of Obamacare crashed and burned just like all the other ones did. There was a lot of talk of this meaning they're done. The reality is it's done for now. There was the last opportunity to operate under the reconciliation for the current budget cycle that ended, it ends today as we're recording this on September 30th. But guess what? There's a new budget cycle that starts tomorrow. So they are currently working out what the budget process will be for the next time around, and they're undoubtedly going to structure it in such a way that they can continue trying on healthcare under reconciliation rules. It's not over. It's going to keep coming back. However, once again, we have a situation where the Republicans, like they did, they tried, after the last couple of times healthcare failed, there's a group of the Republicans who are like, okay, healthcare failed, let's move on to taxes. And so they're trying to do that again. It seems like every time they've tried to do that, somebody pulls them back into healthcare. But they're trying to move on to taxes. And so there's been a lot of talk in the last week about a potential Republican tax plan that would, and they're calling it simplification, tax simplification or reform or whatever. They're talking about reducing the number of tax brackets. They're changing some rates here and there, getting rid of the estate tax that the Republicans have disliked for many, many years, which they call the death tax. I don't know. It's still forming. Any thoughts on this process, Ed?
Well, several things. Number one, I'm a big advocate for simplifying and reforming the tax system, not in lowering taxes, but making it easier to compute. It's almost a religious fervor against hiring someone to do my taxes, so I spend several days every year. My tax system is very simple, and it takes me several days to a couple weeks and a lot of swearing and more than a few bottles of whiskey to compute my taxes.
Well, I've said before on this show, there's, aside from the H&R Block lobby on this thing, there's really no reason that taxes couldn't be fully automatic unless you had something special going on.
Well,
they shouldn't have to, like, for most people, your employer and your financial institutions send in information to the government anyway. Instead of, having to start a 1040 from scratch, it should be, here's your pre-computed taxes. Here's what we think. Got any issues with that? And if the answer is no, you just hit the button and you're done. If the answer is yes, okay, well, then maybe you've got some sort of special situation and you can go and figure that out. But that most people should not have to deal with that. Most people, it should be fully automatic. Maybe you don't even have to hit the button if you've got nothing to worry about.
You're happy with it, it's done, Well, you mentioned there's basically, it sounds to me, there's two lobby groups who are going to fight this, and the one are the CPAs and the attorneys, because a significant number of them make their living from a complex and complicated tax program. The next group are the realtors, and they are already very actively going in there and pointing out that, gee, if you take away the deduction for mortgage interest, people are not going to spend as much money on houses.
But the thing is with both of those arguments, though, it sort of presupposes that we're getting an honest bipartisan tax reform effort where people are really trying to simplify taxes and, you know, make it so that it makes the system makes more sense, the system's fairer or whatever, it's easier for people to compute. That's not what we really have here. What we really have here is yet again a standard. It's not about tax simplification. It's about tax cuts, and there are tax cuts in certain areas that are going to, as usual, the maximum benefit for this is going to come to the higher income folks with more complicated taxes, and there's, you know, they are intending it to be a cut on everybody or as close to everybody as they can manage. But, you know, people are already pointing out in the first day is, okay, these groups actually are probably going to be hit worse and have their taxes go up. And surprise, surprise, those are on the lower end of the income scale.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, you know, if you'll recall in the Reagan tax cuts, I don't know if you're, are you old enough to remember that group?
Only vaguely. I was in high school.
Okay. Well, we were all promised, I was unfortunately paying taxes then, but we were all promised these tax cuts will be for everybody.
High school.
Yeah. If you pay taxes, you will get a tax cut. And that was sort of right, but, you know, The flaw to me is not even so much of who's paying the taxes. If we've got 10% of the people paying 90 to 95% of the taxes, which I don't know what the actual number is, but it's probably not too far off that, then any tax cut you do is obviously going to impact those the wealthiest people the most because they pay the most tax.
And that's one of the things that often is sort of dishonestly described in these things. Because if you're dealing in absolute numbers, well, duh, of course. I think if you start looking at it in percentage terms, you can look at it in a little bit different way and try to understand that better. But there's certainly disinformation on all sides in terms of these to try to spin it in a certain way.
Well, my concern is partially the whole idea is we were talking about taxes being way too complex. The other real concern that I think we ought to don't hear any to talk about at all is what is a reasonable economy growth rate that can be sustainable and can lead to prosperity in the entire nation? And, you know, a couple of years ago, I read Thomas Piketty's book on capital in the 21st century. And in that book, he goes back through centuries. I mean, we're talking 1,000 years or so looking at economic and population growth, both. And it came across to me when I read that a sustainable, long-term, healthy growth rate that will not lead to expansions and busts, you know, sudden inflations and then sudden depressions, is probably not much more than 1 to 1.5% a year, which is, by the way, what we've had for the last 8 years, isn't it?
Right.
And we've had 8 years with continued, nice, gradual growth and no inflation. And no sudden recessions. It's just a long time. Now we're being told we need to have this tax cut, and the reason we need it is because we need to push a 4 to 5% economic growth. 4 to 5% can only come from inflation. We do not generate enough new products and production to have more than 1 to 1.5%, because you just don't grow that much. You'd have to have a population growth, which we don't have anymore, or you would have to have new resources coming into the community. That ain't happening. The only way you get a 4 to 5% growth is from inflation. If you have inflation, then somewhere in depends how long it's going to occur, but you will have a deflation with a recession or a depression. And the only difference is going to be how bad it's going to be. I think the whole idea that we want a 4 or 5% growth rate is innately flawed. And that doesn't even address the issue that any tax cuts you have are going to simply make that wealthier 1 to 5% far wealthier and not benefit the lower 90%.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not steeped enough in economics to make a coherent argument one way or another. I'd love to hear Yvonne's thoughts and others. But I think in general, I've also heard people point out when, and I haven't read the book that you mentioned either, although it was the big rage a couple of years ago when it came out, lots of people talking about it.
Yeah, that's when I read it. It was, yeah. It's interesting. It's a fun read.
But the other thing I've heard people mention is that lots of people, especially baby boomers, sort of think back to, you know, the boom of the 50s and 60s, and that's their version of, that's what normal should be, right? Mm-hmm. Because we had substantial growth, we had this, that, you know, and it continued for an extended length of time. And basically people pointing out that that was really aberrant, actually, and there were exceptional circumstances behind it. One, the unique situations of the immediate post-war period, where we were basically the last one standing with a healthy economy in the world. Two, the baby boom itself and the population growth that surrounded that, and yep. and you know, all of the GIs coming home from World War II and needing something to do, and blah, and all a number of unique situations that apply that. Really, what we're seeing with the more recent economy is more of a reversion to the mean of what was normal before then.
Absolutely. And that was, you know, I think that's what Piketty is basically coming around to saying, is that the things that occurred after the Second World War were population growth, not only here, but throughout the world, because the world had lost a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So the population growth, you can have expansion in the economy without inflation, because there's more people to buy and consume your products, so you can do it. The other thing it had was there was tremendous destruction of infrastructure, which all had to be rebuilt.
Yep.
So then again, you can have expansion without problems. But somewhere around during the Carter administrations, when that all began falling apart because our population had leveled out, we still thought that we should be getting, when we save money in the bank, we should get 4 to 5%. My father, invested in CDs rather than the stock market because he was able at that point to get 10-11% from a CD. Then I pointed out to him that just barely matched inflation, but that's, you know, he was very happy. He had more dollars at the end of the year. But that was such a skewed period of time, and we don't have that anymore. What we have now is a population decrease, especially so if we're not going to allow any more immigrants. I think we could very easily sustain 1%, and we could have a 1%, 2% growth with people gaining in wealth. But to do that, and this comes out of Piketty too near the end of the book, is the skewing of wealth and capital to the upper 1%, upper 10%, is accelerating. And unless we set up a tax, if we want to reform taxes, we have to reform in such a manner that it slows that down and drives some of that capital and wealth down to the at least the middle 50%.
So, Ed, you know, if I summarize everything I've heard you say, it seems like the recommendations for strong economic growth is we just have to have a major war that destroys much of our infrastructure and then outlaw birth control.
Yeah, it does sound that way, doesn't it? I think there's better ways we could do it. We could, get some real economists in there and convince the politicians that they don't want to talk people into wanting a 5% growth rate, and instead look at a sustainable growth rate. Get the politicians to look at, you don't really need to redistribute wealth, but I think we could set up some things that would make the continued concentration of wealth in the hands of very few people harder to do. I can think of a couple of things that seems to me like they would work. You could, for instance, say to corporations, when you are deducting the costs of operating things, any anyone who you pay more than $5 million, you know, the first $5 million that you pay your top wage earners is deductible. But after that, it's not deductible anymore. You can pay them $100 million if you want, but only $5 million is deductible. And we could say to the individual earners, any income you have that's more than $8 or $10 billion a year is taxed at 90%. And what that does, it's you say, well, gee, that's unfair. Well, it's not necessarily. I think that they can get by on $10 million a year. But what you say is, well, we're going to reduce the incentive to concentrate wealth and have them grow the wealth in the form of their companies growing. You know, Warren Buffett has never taken a salary. I think right now he's up to around $225,000 a year. His salary all goes back into the company as growth, as a result of which he has grown to the second richest man in the world, because he doesn't keep taxing his company with a salary of $40-50 million a year.
And there are all sorts of other things you could play with, like, you know, have capital gains taxed higher than regular income instead of less.
You know, well, I think it ought at least be taxed at the same rate.
Or you could do a lot to play with the incentives of things. And yeah. But I don't, you know, I'm actually a little bit uncomfortable in using taxes and the structure of taxes to, you know, experiment with social engineering. But essentially, that's what has been done, you know, for the last 100+ years, you know, is yep. adjusting taxes in various ways to try to affect larger scale aspects of society. And that's where simplification actually would help in terms of the way you get all of this weirdness in the tax structure is, well, we put this little exception in here because we want to encourage people to do that thing. And we'll do this thing over yep. here and we'll do that and we'll do this. And, you know, so I don't know. I would love a situation where you really and truly had committed bipartisan attention to not let's worry about the overall level of taxes, not any of this, but just let's just get rid of most of the existing complexity and start with something as simple as possible, as transparent as possible. And yeah, we want to try to make it fair while we're at it, of course. And, yep. you know, I'm not entirely convinced. Like, there are people who say, well, the simplest thing would be a straight up flat tax. There are other people who say, well, the simplest thing would be just, you know, a transaction tax on every transaction. Yep. Forget about income. But, you know, each one of these has pros and cons in terms of, you know, are you overly impacting low income people over high income people? Are you, yeah. So there's no neutral answer to taxes. There are trade-offs involved here, which is why it's the big political football, of course. But I think it would be useful to try to just pare everything back, get rid of the, you know, 200 page tax code or however long it is. It's probably even bigger than that. I don't know.
Oh, no, it's thousands of pages.
Yeah. Pare all that down, make it as simple as possible. You can take some fundamental principles about how, you know, about distribution and fairness and whatever. And okay, it's going to be hard to get people to agree on those. But no one's even trying at this yeah. point to actually yeah. sort of say, let's get some basic principles in place and then let's get the simplest possible system that achieves those things. Simple's not always the best thing. I mean, and you are pairing, you do have to trade off simplicity versus fairness versus blah, 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 blah. But it's just another one of those things where, and this applies to most problems at this point. I would love to see sort of a actual, honest, let's try to figure something out. Let's figure out where our common ground is and do something that's useful to people, rather than everything being the extreme partisan fights. And I know I'm a squishy moderate when it comes to those kinds of things, and we're not in fashion right now. But
I was going to ask you when you became a commie. You want to help everybody? What's wrong with you?
No, you know, I don't want to help everybody necessarily, but I want to be able to take the problem and try to actually you know, move it forward towards something that is an improvement over where we have today without improvement being measured on, did I win versus the other guy?
Yeah. Well, I think we're basically kind of saying the same things. The taxes should be, taxation should be simple enough that that anyone with a high school degree should be able to do his own taxes. Yeah. And anyone who can't do them, somebody, a volunteer ought to be able to help them because it's just not complicated. Number two, the taxes should generate enough revenue that our government operates on a general rule at a break-even amount. And that doesn't, you know, there are times when the government has to lose money. When you go to war, if it's a just war that you need to fight, the government's going to go in the red. If there is a huge recession that comes along, as happened in 2007, 10 years ago, the fact of the matter is that the only way you're going to get out of that is for the government to go into the red and to stimulate that economy to get going, not with tax cuts, but with money.
Yeah, and also there are certain situations, like if interest rates are less than inflation, then, you know, it may make sense to accumulate debt in that scenario. You know, there are a lot of scenarios there, but I don't know. It's just you don't really get the sort of calm, rational people using real economic arguments deciding what we should do, because everything is put into the frame of Democrats versus Republicans fighting for advantage.
Yep.
So,
yep.
And I think this particular effort for tax reform is really going to be another example of that. But like healthcare, it's an area where even the Republicans amongst themselves have some significant disagreements on what the approach really should be. Also, they're somewhat limited in terms of what they can do on this tax reform proposal, given that they didn't already get a big chunk of savings out of healthcare. So it'll be interesting to see how this debate progresses. On the one hand, you have the dynamic that, yeah, there are all kinds of differences within the Republicans. But then you've got the, hey, we failed utterly on healthcare. Can we at least get something done? Maybe they can get to 50 plus Republican votes in the Senate a little bit easier on tax reform than they can on healthcare, simply because, you know, the argument of, you know, you're going to kill people is a little bit weaker. You might still kill people. Anything the government does can potentially have that effect, but, you know, it's, you're still going to have the argument, well, you're hurting these people. But no matter any change whatsoever is going to hurt somebody, some people, and help some people. And absolutely, you really have to decide on the balance. And hopefully if you design it properly, you know, you minimize how many people are hurt and how much they get hurt. Yeah, as well as just having the average or the mean in a good place. Anyway, it'll be interesting to watch. And we will take a break, and we will come back, and we will talk about kneeling back after this.
Facebook, Facebook, Facebook. Hey, do you want to help support Curmudgeon's Corner? Well, right now, the best way is through Facebook. If you haven't already liked us on Facebook and you actually, well, like us, then go search for Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook and like our page. It will help you see when we announce new episodes, and it'll help us reach more new people too. If you like a particular episode, like our episode announcement post too, or share it with your friends. All of this helps spread the word about our podcast to more people who might like it as well. And of course, we love having a conversation with all of you listeners, so please use Facebook to leave comments on the shows, give us suggestions, or anything else like that. It's always great to hear from you. So, if you want to help the show, use Facebook. Or forget all of that and just send us money.
Okay, we are back. So, I believe anybody listening to this show is familiar with the hubbub that happened with the NFL and kneeling and Trump making comments about it and all this back and forth. What are your thoughts, Ed?
Well, you know, I think the best thing I've seen on this whole thing was a little brief column and an op-ed by the man who joined Kaepernick in kneeling. Kaepernick, in his the first week or maybe 2 weeks that he did this protest, he sat on a chair during right. the anthem. And then this other teammate of his talked to him, and apparently they even talked to a veteran who came to them and said, you know, it upsets me that you're sitting in a chair. And this guy convinced them that they should kneel, that that would be a symbol of respect for the flag, and yet would make their point without, you know, that he said, when you sit during that upsets me. I was over there getting shot at and had friends who got killed. And I think, you know, ultimately when we kneel to people, I've never heard that characterized as being some sort of a symbol of disrespect. Where do you kneel? You kneel if you're praying. If you're religious and you pray, you kneel. If you are a knight, you kneel as the king dubs you and gives you a name and makes you a knight. You kneel to the queen. You kneel to. I mean, we do all sorts of kneeling things, and it's always a symbol of respect and you know, towards whatever you're kneeling to. So what we've got is people who are just determined to fight and hate each other, and they decided that this thing that apparently to Kaepernick was showing his respect for the flag while still making a demonstration has become a hate symbol. And that, you know, I spent 27 years in the military, and as a number of our military people have pointed out, we swore to protect and defend the Constitution, not the flag. And the Constitution says that people have the right to speak and say and kneel where in the hell they want. So, I find it a disturbing thing to see how polarized it's become, and how very far wrong an awful lot of our population are, including some people who I like and talk with on occasion.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that I honestly have had. I try generally really hard to sort of understand where people who disagree with me are coming from, and I have trouble on this one because it's like I just. First of all, the people who engaged in this protest initially, and we'll talk a little bit about how it expanded this last week, but the Kaepernick, is that how you say his name?
I was yeah, I think so. I spelled it about 15 different ways, but I think it's Kaepernick.
Anyway.
It's N-I-C-K.
the fundamentally, they're protesting police violence and racial injustice. I mean, that's where they were coming from. They were very clear about what message they were trying to send. And so people who are interpreting this as, you know, I hate the flag, I hate the anthem, I hate my country, are being intentionally obtuse as far as I can tell.
I think you're absolutely right.
You know, if they were actually protesting this, I could maybe understand it a little bit better, but these people have been very articulate describing exactly what they are protesting and what they are upset about it. And as you said, there's a whole story there about why they're kneeling rather than taking some other form of protest because of exactly that. It's they're still showing a sign of respect, but they're calling out something and still, you know, so you're not listening. You know, the people who are upset about this just fundamentally aren't listening, or it's not really about the flag for them either. And they're upset about what's being protested.
Well, I mean, I think you're exactly right in that. It's, you know, it's well, this is the wrong place to object. Where is the right place? Tell me where black citizens in this country who have been now hundreds of years in various degrees of repression. Where and when is it appropriate for them to protest what has happened to them and what is still happening to them?
Absolutely. And because there's never a right place. You always hear the, well, that's not the right way. That's not the right way. That's not. Well, what is the right way? Well, the right. I've seen the joke repeated. Well, and this is not a new one. But the right place to protest is alone in your house with the lights off quietly.
Isn't that where we were told back when I was a little kid that was how we should pray?
You know, because it seems like in many cases, the only acceptable protest is the protest you don't see. And of course, the protest you don't see is not having an effect. The whole point of a protest is to sort of get in your face so you can see, hey, there are a lot of people upset about this. Maybe I should go about understanding why they're upset. And understand the situation a little bit.
Well, the hopeful thing out of it that I think is that Kaepernick and the people following him seem to have gotten the message that if you want your protest to have any chance of succeeding eventually, it's got to be nonviolent. If people attack you and these, you just are committed to being nonviolent. So Kaepernick basically has surrendered his career for this and has been nonviolent. He hasn't even gotten up and yelled and screamed, "You bastards, you fired me from my job because I did this." He just accepted the fact that he was going to lose his career by doing this, and that's making a hell of a statement. And there are people out there that are hearing that, I think. And as more and more guys join him dealing there, I think that message is going to get louder.
Well, and I'm definitely one that thinks, you know, nonviolence is the way to go. But I also understand some of the frustrations where people are like, you know, we weren't getting what we needed nonviolently, so maybe I am going to break a window or something occasionally. Yeah. And
trouble is that I can understand that and I appreciate it, but the fact is that history is not on the side of winning through, you know, these sorts of things through violence. It doesn't happen.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, you know, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, I mean, major societal change often happens through violent revolution. So I don't know that it's I mean, I don't think that's the right way to do it, but I don't think it's true to say that you can't achieve change like that. It happens all the time.
There are times when revolutions are necessary, you know, or at least are going to occur. However, the other thing is that an awful lot of those revolutions have ended up basically reforming the same sort of government again.
Very,
you know, our government went from a representational democracy republic to a representational democracy republic. You know, the Brits, we had elected legislators. It was a democracy. We just didn't like who was at the top of the democracy at that time. The French, it took them a long time to finally get it right, but they basically put a republic in over several tries. The Russians had one. They put in a democracy for about a year or two, and then said, "Oh no, we liked it back when it was a dictatorship."
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to be misinterpreted here. I think the nonviolent approach is the better approach. It's the right approach. You want to try to achieve things by changing people's mind and convincing them and moving things whenever at all possible, and I don't think violence is the right way to go. Yep. So I do think that they are taking the right approach with these kinds of things. And, you know, the people getting all upset about it, I'm like, you couldn't design a better protest here.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the other side of this is that, and I don't remember the quote, but I saw one from Martin Luther King earlier today that I'll paraphrase it, but basically said, you know, we are being nonviolent and I'm committed to nonviolence, but at some point, if we don't achieve any of these aims, some son of a bitch is going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing it wildly, but the bottom line is eventually, if this happens, you can't control the crowds forever. And if you continue beating them down, the French did it because they were tired of starving.
Well, another famous quote, and I don't remember who it's by, is that the one way to guarantee violent revolution is to make it impossible to change things peacefully.
Yeah, same idea.
Now the one other thing I wanted to talk about, though, is, beyond those initial protests, is Donald Trump's statement about it. Basically, this issue had disappeared. I mean, like 6 months or a year ago or whenever it was that Kaepernick initially did this, there was a big sort of dust up about it, and it basically disappeared. It was not on the radar. And then Donald Trump brought it up again, intentionally, I think, to inflame that issue. And there were a couple stories about how, he's stoking the culture war or whatever. Because then all of a sudden you get, first of all, by him trying to tell the NFL what they can and can't do, and specifically NFL players what they can and can't do, he got a whole bunch of them upset. Meanwhile, he's stoking up his own base to be upset about the fact that, they're protesting the flag, they're protesting the anthem, they're un-American. And so he basically took this, this issue that was basically gone and reignited it.
Yep.
And I think the NFL players and stuff, fell right into this trap. They responded to him by saying, well, we're all going to kneel. And then some of them, some of the teams stayed in the locker room for the anthem instead of coming out at all. And, there were all kinds of different ways that they responded to, but it all was stuff that provoked, strong reactions on all sides. And then we ended up talking about this thing for a week. And as many people have pointed out, well, he should have been paying attention to Puerto Rico. And then other people are like, well, but you're dismissing, the protests as if they don't matter, and they do matter. And so, even people who are natural allies were sort of fighting against each other of like, is the right point here that, the protests, the NFL protests are a distraction from the quote unquote real issue? Well, but police violence is a real issue. So it's not. And then there are a lot of the protesters as well in the NFL and elsewhere who are like trying to now expand this and say, well, and maybe it started out against racial injustice and police violence, but now these protests are anti-Trump protests. And, it completely diluting that original message. And, so this, I view this as something that I don't think Trump is like this brilliant genius, but he's got an instinct for this kind of stuff, and he likes fighting. He's said it multiple times in various venues over the years. He likes fighting. He likes scrapping. And so if things, it's one of the things he does is just intentionally throw a bomb into the middle of something to see what blows up.
Well, he thrives on chaos, and he thrives on chaos within his staff. I had a commander in the military once who is scary how similar to Trump he was. But he loves this chaotic environment. And he looks for places to say, hey, I bet I can get them fighting. And sometimes I almost wonder if I can't imagine he's this wise, but maybe he did this so that the protesters would win. Maybe he's in favor of what Kaepernick wants. And so he says, hey, I
kind of doubt that there.
Well, I do too, but God.
But I think what he saw there is an opportunity to, fire up his base. Get them all riled up and excited about this, and look at all those bad football players, and of course there's a very heavy racial component to this because the original protest was racially based, and I think that and, you know, some people are like, well, he's distracting from the Russia thing, or he's distracting from whatever this week's scandal is. I mean, we don't have on the agenda the whole thing with Secretary Price and his $1 million worth of private jet flights. And apparently there's some other cabinet secretaries who have similar things going on, you know. It was a distraction from all this kind of stuff. Not to mention, of course, Donald himself, you know, and all his trips. But,
well, you know, I can't let us go without getting a little bit about gerrymandering in. So I want to point out that our my state senator, you know, the state legislature senator, who's been there for 12 years, sits on the committee that could get the gerrymandering bill to the floor. And he has basically said publicly that he will not work to have that happen because it's just too, we don't have time to work on that. But this week he introduced a bill to have the state legislature condemn the Pittsburgh Steelers for staying in the field house during the anthem. So he has time to infringe upon our constitutional rights, but not time to guarantee that my vote gets counted.
There you go. So anyway, protests.
His name, by the way, is McElhinney.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have now gone from being neutral to him to actually going to actively work to have him not elected next year. But that's another issue altogether.
Okay, and since we've moved on from the protests and we've had that, let's take a break. We will come back and with one more segment maybe for our last three topics, which are a little bit about Obamacare and how this administration is handling it, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and a little bit about energy. We'll be back after this. No, it's not the beginning of the show again. We're just taking a little time to credit the artist responsible for the music we use at the beginning and end of the show. What you are listening to right now is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. The music we close our show with is Celestial Soda Pop. Both of these songs are from Deep Breakfast. Now platinum, Deep Breakfast was the first independently released album ever to be certified gold by the RIAA. Ray Lynch's other albums are The Sky of Mind, No Blue Thing, Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening, and The Best of Ray Lynch. You can check out Ray Lynch or buy his music at raylynch.com, iTunes, Amazon, or anywhere you usually find music. Okay, so Obamacare, the administration. This was on your list. I presume the topic was sort of how the administration is cutting back on open enrollment opportunities and not advertising it. And
two fairly specific things. One is that the open enrollment period has been cut, is it by about 50% the length of time that they can open and enroll?
I think something like that. Plus, they've scheduled routine maintenance on the website for like every weekend.
Yep.
Through the whole open enrollment period.
And just to make sure people don't know that this is occurring, that they don't have as much time to enroll as they did last year, the advertising budget was cut 90%.
Yep.
So they don't have any money to get out and say, you need to get enrolled right now. So basically, I mean, he's made no bones about it. He said all along, I'm going to destroy Obamacare. And I don't like calling it that. It's the Affordable Care Act.
Yep.
And he uses that term, Obamacare, to get people, because if you don't like Obama, then you're opposed to it. It's the Affordable Care Act. I think this may be the death knell for it in some ways, because if people don't enroll, then it's going to become a real problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, this is definitely part of it. And some of this has gone to court in terms of, well, but he's legally required to do certain things at this point. And I think, but he's using his flexibility to basically do the minimum that's legally required.
Yep.
Whereas there's a lot of discretion there where he could do a lot more, but he's not going to. And this is part of the effort to, take the problems that the existing law does have. And as you said, Donald Trump has been completely open about this. If the repeal and replace attempts all failed, the backup strategy is make it fail as fast as it can, so that therefore there's no choice but to do something else.
Yep.
And so, you know, we'll continue to see that play out. There are a lot of independent efforts out there where people are trying to fund their own advertising to let people know and things like that.
Yeah.
They're probably not going to be able to put in the same kind of budget that the federal government would have. We'll see how it goes. And there's still also that bipartisan group that's trying to do ACA fixes that apparently they've got, you know, more than a majority of the Senate potentially on board with this, but not the Republican leadership and not the president at this point, so that it's probably not going to come up. But there is a bipartisan effort that's saying, that basically is saying, okay, let's figure out the specific problems we have, make those better, patch it up, and sort of kick the can down the road, but without letting the whole thing collapse. There is a degree of bipartisan support for that, but there's all sorts of structural impediments to anything like that actually happening, at least at the moment. That may change, yep. And it may change quickly. We'll see. But
I don't know. Our legislators are experts at avoiding these sorts of things. So these bills that are a benefit to all of us that ought to be going through never make it to the floor.
Well, they're also expert at kicking cans down the road. Like, if there's something that they can do that basically extends the status quo and just pushes it so that, okay, we don't have to make the decision, let's kick it into the next Congress. Congress is really good at that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anything else on ACA, or did you want to talk about?
No, I think it's it's just kind of if you will, it's like that massive iceberg that fell off. It's just getting ready to fall, and I don't know that we can do anything to stop it anymore. But hopefully not. Hopefully it'll get fixed, and our kids will have a good healthcare program.
So. Julia Louise Dreyfus announced this week that she has breast cancer. What did you want to comment on that?
Oh, yeah, just mostly, you know, she's. I've always enjoyed her humor and her personality and stuff. And it's kind of sad to see that she's got this illness. Looking through the sites today, there's the usual stuff. I mean, there's people don't like her because she's too liberal for them. So there, you know, there was one posting. I said, "Hope the bitch dies," and that kind of stuff.
That's so nice on the internet.
It's just isn't it? Yeah, isn't it pathetic? I mean, she's a neat lady, and but neat people get sick too. So hopefully she'll do well and keep entertaining us because she is funny.
And finally, as we're lightning rounding it through these last few things, you wanted to talk about energy. What about energy?
Well, you know, and this comes from something I just saw very briefly today or heard. Apparently, I forget who it was. God, it's bad. I should take notes. But anyway, they're talking about the carbon imprint of the United States. And this particular person commented that even without the federal government supporting the Paris Accord acts anymore, the fact is that we are at or ahead of our agreements on the Paris Accords in our cuttings of carbon production in the United States, which I found kind of mind-boggling. They said something. I think 40% of our coal-powered plants are offline now. The president keeps saying he's going to resurrect coal, mm-hmm. but I don't know who he's going to sell it to. He's not going to sell it to the United States because our coal energy plants are going away. He might sell it to China, but China's going solar, and so I don't know that they're going to build any new plants.
Yeah, China, there are reports out of China this week as well that they're putting in place regulations that all new cars are going to have to be electric at a certain timetable at like 20 years out or something. But
Well, California's talking about doing that in California too.
Yep.
Saying the hell if the feds won't do it, we'll do it in California. So I guess the encouraging thing is maybe we will actually start doing some energy wise things. The other talk I heard today was with our Secretary of the Interior talking about energy. Now, why the Secretary of the Interior would talk about the energy portfolio is not clear to me, other than the fact that the federal government owns a huge amount of the land where one mines coal and oil and natural gas. And he was making it very clear that under his guidance, we will become, he didn't say energy independent, but energy, I think the word he was using was dominant, meaning that we'll have the power to determine how energy comes and is used and these sorts of things, because we will mine more oil and coal and gas. And he also, somewhere along the line, he threw in a little bone of saying, oh, yes, we're going to do more solar and wind and geothermal, too. But it's very clear that he envisions the Department of the Interior becoming a dominant energy producer in this nation, or enabler, if you will. Yeah.
Well, and that's sometimes been its role in the past as well, in terms of managing that stuff. Yeah. Since we're talking environment, I'll throw in for a second. I saw a movie. It was a while back at this point, but I saw Al Gore's An Inconvenient Sequel. That was his 2017 update to An Inconvenient Truth from a couple decades ago, whenever that was. I guess not quite that far, but it was different. I mean, I had seen the original Inconvenient Truth many, many years back. This was a little bit different. It wasn't. It certainly had some of the graphs and charts and pictures of, the ice in Greenland melting and stuff like that. But a lot of it was about the negotiations for the Paris Accords and how they played out. And, Al Gore was kind of highlighting his own little role in it. He tried to help make a deal that helped push things over to the edge. And I don't know if his role in it was exaggerated in his own movie. I sort of suspect it was a little bit. But, he sort of played up like how he was trying to do this. And it was clearly, as the movie was playing out, it seemed like the intention was that it was going to be sort of a triumphalist, we got the Paris Accords done, we're finally making some progress in these directions, blah, 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 and then Trump won. And then Trump announced that he was pulling out of the Paris Accords and all this. So you see the flow of the movie as, we're doing all this hard work to try to get this done, and here's all the bad things that are happening in the world. Here's how it's really important that we start doing this kind of thing, and then we finally were able to get it all together, and it's maybe not as much as we need to, but at least we're making some progress. Paris Accords. Oh, Donald Trump just canceled it.
and then it
ends like with Al Gore and all his folks sort of clearly depressed about about how it's turned out, but sort of saying, okay, we have to pick ourselves up again and figure out what to do from here and blah blah blah. It was a very interesting movie. I mean, as with the first one, it's clearly pushing a point of view. And it's one where, from everything I've read, I agree with the science and stuff. There are more questions about, though, what is the right way to attack this from a policy perspective. I have no patience for the people who are deniers that, you know, this doesn't even happen or humans aren't responsible. It's like, nope. That's ridiculous. Of course it's happening. Of course humans are responsible. Now there's an open question. Well, what do we do about it? If anything, or do we let it happen and figure out how to adapt to the changes? You know,
I think we don't have much choice in the matter. Exactly. I think the amount of carbon in the atmosphere at this point is making it inevitable that there's going to be huge changes on down. The ocean temperature has increased enough at this point that there are irreversible changes coming. What we can do is maybe mitigate against that, how severe it could be, by cutting down carbon production severely. But I think it looks to me like the economies of the alternative fuels, specifically solar, wind, geothermal is a little slower, but is coming up there. Wave energy, the energies coming from that are rapidly becoming cheaper than petroleum.
And I think
we're going to stop burning petroleum.
Yeah, this is the argument that Yvonne has always made on this, is that in the end, you know, all of this sort of governmental initiative stuff is not going to do the trick. The trick is going to be when the economics on their own change to make it so that these alternatives are actually cheaper. And then you'll see change very quickly.
Yeah,
because people will gravitate towards.
I think we're on the cusp of that sort of change right now, because the various estimates you see sounds like solar production of energy is pretty much competitive with petroleum right now. The big thing still waiting is how do we store it so that we have a continuous supply, you know, batteries or other things.
Can be
done.
Part of that also, though, in terms of the argument about policy versus just let the economics take their course, is that a lot of the development in these alternative fuel areas have been spurred by either direct governmental support of the companies mm-hmm. experimenting in those areas, or tax credits to people who buy their products, or various other things that sort of try to manipulate things and push things in that direction. Yeah. That's not to say that it wouldn't happen at some point regardless, just naturally as things progress. But I think it's hard to say that there hasn't been a governmental role here, because governments all over the world have been pushing things in this direction and changing policies and taxes and all kinds of other things to sort of encourage this behavior. Everything from, you know, mileage requirements for cars to tax credits for putting solar panels on your roof, all of this stuff. And so there is an involvement there, but so I don't know. Is there a governmental role here? Probably.
I think there absolutely is, and I'm not saying that it needs to go away. I think it should be expanded. I think we're reaching a point where it could become more focused. For instance, the government at this point, I think, probably needs to be looking at investing more into some of these storage systems, investing more into how do we integrate the home solar system with the infrastructure of electrical distribution, the grid. There's lots of places for it.
Well, and there's resistance to that too from ingrained in infrastructure as well, not just from the petroleum industry and all of that, but you know, we've seen during the Hurricane Irma response, one of the things that I saw repeatedly pointed out is Florida has passed various laws that make it a finable offense to use your solar panels when the power was out. You know, and it's like, really? Really?
Because I'm not sure why that would be, but there's one reason for that. But I think that's one of the things that happened. If you're generating power and the power goes out, the linemen have to get out there and they start working on the lines. Well, they turn the power off to the line so it's safe. But right. if your house is generating electricity, if there's not a breaker in there, then the guys can get electrocuted.
Right. Well, but of course there should
that
be.
Is
that's
well,
all controllable.
That's required. It's part and required of it, but maybe there are people done their own. I don't know.
And also there are various regulations apparently in place in multiple states where even if you are set up to be fully self-sufficient in terms of power, your house is required to be connected to the grid. You know, things like this, where I think really, like, if you look 50 or 100 years down the road, I think where we would want to be, if we could at all possibly get there, is to not have a grid at all. But every building you build has its own power supply.
Yeah.
It's all local.
Yeah, that makes sense. Florida, by the way, has not been particularly solar friendly.
Right.
We put a solar collector on the house that we have in Jacksonville, and we did get a federal tax report. We don't pay taxes in Florida because that's not our this is vacation home. We pay property tax. But for instance, one of the things that a lot of states have is a means that you can actually sell electricity to the grid.
Yes, absolutely.
And Florida does not allow that to happen. And the reason that becomes important is that a lot of people have another way to make it more affordable is you lease your solar system rather than paying for it like I did. Florida does not allow the leasing. And so if I generate more electricity than I use at our house, we are selling it back, but we get paid at the lowest rate rather than what we're paying. So if I say I pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour and I generate more than I use, I might get paid 3 cents a kilowatt hour for what I send back to them.
Okay, very well. One last topic I do want to touch on before we wrap up the show that I didn't list earlier, but when I mentioned it sometime in the last segment, I realized we should mention something about this, is Secretary Price did resign tonight.
Oh, yes.
Because he was caught using private planes. He racked up $1 million worth of bills and offered to pay back $54,000, I think it was.
Sounds pretty fair, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, the $54,000 was for his own seats on the private jets. Not taking into the account that the jet wouldn't have been going at all if it wasn't for him. But anyway, apparently he decided after he had a bad experience trying to fly a commercial or something and missed an event because his plane was delayed or canceled or something. Who knows? And it sounds like he just decided, okay, well then fuck it. I'm gonna charter private planes everywhere I go. And racked up quite a few bills, and there were reports that some of these were, I don't know if there was some sort of official cover for it, but he flew home to Tennessee to have lunch with his son, things like this, and this is not the first one. Of course, we saw Secretary Mnuchin,
Mnuchin. Yeah.
With the trip to see the eclipse, and I thought I saw something.
No. He didn't see. He didn't.
Yeah, he was
he
going
went
to
down there
Knox.
To see the gold.
He went to
he
see went the to, gold, yeah.
Because it's really important. The Secretary of the Treasury needs to go look at all those stacks of gold.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, by the way, there's a huge storehouse of morphine in there, too, as a medically essential thing to store.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that until I was stationed at Fort Knox.
I know that there's another big stash of gold at the Fed in New York City as well.
Yep.
But anyway, so and apparently these two are not the only ones. And I mentioned in passing a little while ago, and of course, Donald Trump himself going off to his golf courses every weekend and costing quite a bit of money. So it's like there were reports of Donald Trump being really upset by Price and what he's doing, and he shouldn't be doing this stuff. And it's like, you look at yourself a little bit, maybe? I don't know.
If you work for Donald Trump, the words that you don't ever want to hear are, he's a good man. Right? Because the few people that he has fired since he took over as president, a day or two before he fires them, he has said, he's really a good man.
Yep. Well, and you say few people, but the list is growing. There's yeah, now it's growing there's, in there's now like 15 or 20 people from his administration that have been kicked out for one thing or another, and you know.
Yeah, but how many should have been kicked out?
Well,
you know. Shame on me.
So anyway, I don't know. Is he ever going to pay back the $1 million? I don't think. Now that he's left, he doesn't have to pay back anything, right?
I doubt that he'll pay the $52,000, to tell you the truth. Price has a long history of financial finagling, in his various offices.
Well, and he also, I saw all kinds of people posting quotes from him from years ago where he was criticizing other officials for exactly the same kind of stuff. And trying to be the hardline, government should be really good about its money and not waste anything and blah, 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 blah. And of course, here you go.
Yeah. Yeah. But he doesn't consider it wasteful. It's, it's important for him to get to these meetings.
Well, it's just like one of these statements, and I'm going to forget which congressperson this was, but there was an interview being done with a Republican congressperson about how, all the tax programs that we were just talking about would probably add to the deficit because they were cutting taxes without any corresponding, cut in spending. And any speculation of Laffer curve type stuff where we're cutting tax rates, but you'll end up with more taxes has not been borne out. And nobody's actually predicting that at this point.
Trump is. Trump says we're going to have 4-5% growth.
The reporter asked him basically, like, well, what about the deficit? And don't you care about the deficit? You guys in the Republican Party have been talking about deficits for forever, and how important those were. And the congressman actually came right out directly and said, well, that's a good talking point when there's a Democrat in the White House and a Democratic Congress, but we've got a Republican Congress and a Republican president, so not so much anymore.
I think that was Paul Ryan. I can't swear to
it. No, that wasn't wasn't Ryan.
Wasn't him? Wasn't Ryan. Okay. It sounds like something he would say. Shame on me, huh?
Yeah.
I know it wasn't Rand Paul, because Paul may be an idiot, but at least he's a consistent idiot.
So I looked it up.
It was
Representative Mark Walker, a Republican of North Carolina. He's the chairman of the Republican Study Committee, which is a group of about 150 conservative House members. And the exact quote was, "It's a great talking point when you have an administration that's Democrat-led. It's a little different now that the Republicans have both houses and the administration."
Yep. That's our leadership. Isn't it wonderful? Well, the estimates I'm seeing on the addition to the deficit at this point are between 1.5 and 2 trillion over the next 10 years. And that's on top of the, I think we're right, this year we're slated for $800 billion deficit. So I guess what they're saying is that instead of only being 8 trillion more in 10 years, we'll be about 10 trillion more in 10 years. So it'll be up to 30 trillion total.
Okay, with that, I think we've rambled a little bit, and so we should just wrap it up.
Sounds good. Okay.
So thanks, everybody, again, for joining us on Curmudgeon's Corner.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, thank you, Ed, specifically for joining us on Curmudgeon's Corner. I always like it when you are able to jump in and guest host at the last minute, and I really do appreciate it, because there were only a couple hours notice this time around. So So really, really nice of you to be able to do this at the last minute. For all of our listeners out there, as usual, go find us on Facebook, facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner. There you can see the posts announcing the episodes, and you can go to the post for this episode and add comments and tell us what you think of what we've said and what we got right and what we got wrong and suggestions for things we should talk about in the future, all of that kind of lovely stuff. And If you really like us, go to Patreon, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. You can throw us a buck here or a buck there. We always appreciate that to help defray the costs of the show. This is a labor of love. We lose money on every episode we do. This is not something that we're getting rich off of or anything like that. So any little bit helps if you want to help out. And let's see what else. I'm on Twitter at Abulsme, ABULSME. Feel free to drop me a line there as well. So thanks everybody, and thank you, Ed. And hopefully Yvonne will be back next week and will be able to tell us about a little bit more about what's going on with Puerto Rico, with his personal contacts there and how his little flight went. We'll see. So thanks everybody. Have a great week. Goodbye.
Okay. Good night.